we were talking with the lead team, but it was more like, ha, your route is hard? Yes, it's hard. For example, that was the conversation. Nothing more. All of the females can reach. It's for sure not morpho. And we were checking like really a lot of times, and we put a lot of tension about it. We never consider pregnancy as a disability. And I really wanted to continue my climbing, even if I'm pregnant. During the first day of setting, like I skipped the first day because I was in the hospital, but I was barely able to walk on the first floor in the hotel.
Welcome to another episode of the That's Not Real Climbing podcast. I'm your host, Jenny, and I'm excited to introduce my guest for today, Olga Niemitz. Olga is an official IFSC route setter, and she recently came back from Paris where she helped set the Olympic boulder rounds. In this episode, we'll learn about what it takes to become an IFSC setter, what it was like setting at the Olympics and trying to make the rounds fair, and how she balances setting, training, and travel, all while being a single mother. It's insane. I hope you enjoy this episode with Olga. How was your vacation after the Olympics, after Paris?
I took 1 week of holidays in Portugal, and that was good. That was good, quite calm. I was just surfing, no climbing at all. So that was a pleasure.
How long have you been surfing?
I'm totally beginner. Okay. But I guess it's kind of my second love, and I really want to go for it as often as possible.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit hard for you to get opportunities to surf, I assume. You live in, I guess, where do you live right now?
Poland.
Yeah, it doesn't really seem like a surfing location.
Not really. I have 1 hour to the mountains, so, and 6 to the sea, so.
So hard to get practice in. I just tried surfing for the second time a few weeks ago, and it is fun. I think I get it. I might try to get into it.
It's just great. It's just great.
Yeah, maybe one day we can try it sometime.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Yeah, so let's get right into it. How long have you been climbing, and how did you get into climbing?
I'm climbing since I was a kid. Both of my parents are climbers. So I started I was barely walking when I started climbing. But yeah, because my parents were taking me to the cracks and they were climbing and I was just hanging around. I started climbing I wanted to start climbing when I was around 7, I guess. Until that time, I'm climbing with a few breaks in between.
And then you also used to compete a bit yourself, right?
Correct. When I was a kid, when I was 7, I've already started to train with the small group of the kids in Poland, and we already started also to compete in the competition in Poland as kids. So since always, I guess.
Okay, so you're kind of like a team kid too.
Yes, it's kind of funny. I started actually with the group where it was Marcin Wszołek, another EFSC road setter right now. And we are in the same group with the kids because we're from the same city.
Okay. So how long did you compete for?
Well, I stopped after 1.5, 2 years, more or less. And he was continue climbing. Yeah, because I was interested in a different stuff that time. And then I came back again after a 1 year break, and they were way better than me. So I joined to the different group, and then I was climbing 1 or 2 years, and I stopped again for 1, 2 years, and I was like going to this and coming back, and it was like, I don't, I've never climbing like full. That 20 years.
So you didn't have like competition climbing aspirations as an athlete?
I did, but when I was around 14, 15, 16, and that time I was competing a lot in the Polish Cups, Polish Junior Cups. I was on the podium, Then I turned to be senior, and I was still competing as a senior, and I was also competing in the finals. Basically all the time in the finals of the national competition.
Okay. Did you ever do like international competitions?
No, just once. I was not ready. It was just three spot, and I just took this spot, and then so I competed in the World Cup one time, but I was almost last, I guess. But I fell from four holders on the top, so not so far. But result was poor.
Nothing wrong with that. How did you make the decision to retire from competing and I guess eventually get into route setting?
So when I was 15, I was also snowboarding, and I was in the national team of snowboard. And so I was competing in two sports in the same time, in winter, more on the board, summer more climbing. And I was more focused on snowboard. I even joined to the Olympic team. I qualified for Olympic Games in snowboard. And I quit like half 6 months before Olympics. I don't know, maybe 8 months before. Because we didn't agree with my coach. It was a big problem. And I said, like, I don't want to do it anymore. I just want to climb, and I quit from snowboard. And So, beginning of then I started just climbing, and I was focused just on climbing.
Whoa, wait, okay. So I had no idea about this whole snowboarding thing. So you were going to be an Olympic snowboarder?
Yeah.
Wow. So you were doing like, you were competing in two different things at once, I guess. That's kind of a lot to handle.
Yeah, but that time snowboard was like the first sport for me. I was really focused on that. And climbing was like just my passion, and I just love to do it. And it was just on the side, let's say. So when I was competing, I was going to the finals, but never with the huge success because it was not what I was focused about. Yeah, and I stopped snowboarding when I was 21. So it was already a bit too late for a real career as a climber athlete.
Well, I guess you at least eventually made it to the Olympics in some way. So that's really cool. So at what age did you get into route setting?
In one point, we had a huge international competition in Poland. And I was already competing this competition in previous years. So I was expecting I will be in the finals. But I knew like during the final day of the competition, I will be already in Spain for outdoor climbing because I bought the tickets to Spain before they announced the competition date. So I really wanted to be a part of this competition, and I thought like, okay, if I can compete, maybe I can set the competition, but why not? And I asked my friend who was the organizer, maybe it's possible to join. And he said, okay, I will ask the chief. I think yes, but let's see. And the chief agreed, my friend agreed, and that's how I ended up in the team.
Okay. It's kind of crazy that they just let you set just from asking, not knowing how your setting was before then.
I think they didn't know I never set.
Yeah. I mean, you'd think they would be able to tell once you started setting. Like the first time.
I don't know. Nobody said nothing. They were to focus on their boulders. That was cool. I mean, they knew that I'm a good climber. And my climbing level is high enough to set this kind of competition. So I think that time nobody really think about it, about experience and setting. The team was experienced. I was, of course, working for free. So yeah. They just said, okay. Go for it.
So was that actually like literally your first time setting ever?
Yes. Yes. And it was a big competition with international athletes, like really good. That time that was Rubtsov. He was winning the World Cups, and he registered as one of the athletes and a few different people. So for me, it was a huge event. But even from Poland, it was quite big.
Do you like remember what you were feeling at the time as you were setting your first time?
Yeah, because I didn't know what should I expect. Then I had no expectations before. I just wanted to have a fun and climb on the final boulders. That was my goal. And it turned up, it's something what I like to do, like in my life. And I think I was surprised how nice is it, how fun is it, how good is it, how big pleasure I can have. During the setting and during the competition days, I just remember it was good time for me.
I still just can't really wrap my head around how you set finals boulders your first time, because I've only tried route setting once, and it just, like, I had an idea in mind of like a move I wanted to set or maybe how I wanted something to feel, but it just didn't come through at all. So, like, how did you make that happen the first time?
Well, I don't know exactly what was in my head that time. I guess I've just put the holes on the wall. I tried to find a nice section in between them, I guess. But it was not really, I want this move, and I tried to put the move on the wall. I don't think so. It was this way. It's randomly I work like that. So maybe it was just a freestyle. I liked it.
Okay. I guess maybe you just have, maybe it comes naturally to you somehow.
I don't know. I think it's easier if you're an athlete. You were an athlete. You know what you expect. You exactly know the level of the boulder which should be on the wall. So it's a bit more natural than to came from nowhere and try to set the boulder where you don't actually know the level of the.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So then when did you become an IFSC route setter?
It happened in 2021. I got an official appointment as a junior route setter.
Okay. So how did you get that? I don't really, I think like me and a lot of other listeners don't really know the process for becoming like an official IFSC route setter. I think also a lot of people don't know that there is a difference between official IFSC route setters and I guess just like setters who set for a few World Cups. So can you sort of explain the difference between official setters and how you, I guess, got that junior setting license?
So we have a pool of around 40 international IFSC route setters. And we are able to set the World Cups, World Championships, youth competition, etc., etc. And each year we are nominated to set around two competition per person. And these nominations are fully made by IFSC. They are official. You can find them on the IFSC website. If you are not IFSC roadster, you can't be nominated by the International Federation. You can, like now the, well, few years ago, process was not super clear. Now it's really clear, and it said that if you, like, exactly this year, a lot of things changed. So I'm not sure if I should tell you how it is exactly now or how it was when I was starting.
Both.
So now the system a bit changed, and we have the levels. So there is level 1, 2, 3, and 4 of IFSC road setters. Level starting from level 4, that means you can be the chief or the World Cups or the high level competition like Olympic Games or World Championships. Level 3, you mean you can be the part of the team of the highest level competition, but also you can be chief of the lowest round competition like European Cups or Asia Cups. Level 2 means you can be chief of the continental cups, but like you are not nominated, you won't have nominations for the World Cups, so it's like level lower. Level 1 means you can't be the chief of the continental cups, but you can be the part of the team.
So yeah, for like level 2, maybe not like chiefing World Cups, but can you still set at World Cups?
No, okay, so from down. So level 1, you can be the team of the Continental Cups. Level 2, you can be the chief of the continental cups. Level 3, you can be the chief of the continental cups, but also you can be the team member of the World Cups.
Okay.
Level 4, you can be the chief of the World Cups.
Okay, cool. That makes sense. And so this is like brand new this year?
Yes, it happened this year and in February, I think. So they made this hierarchy, and it's full. Everything is on the website of the FSC page, so you can find it. Like everybody can find it, and then the list with the names and the levels which they get. Before that, we didn't have levels. It was just the IFSC title, and that was level 3 and level 4. They was together, but separated by like chief IFSC, IFSC chiefs, and just IFSC road setters. And level 1 and level 2, it was, I think it was managing by the European Council, Asia Council, etc., etc. So those road setters who were nominated for the Continental Cups, they were not in the official pool, but somehow the names were written somewhere. But I don't really know how it was, because I've never been in this European pool. So I can't really tell you how it was before.
Okay. And so then how did you, you said you got into it because you had a junior setting license?
Yes, so they created for a couple of years, like 2 or 3 maximum. It was like junior, maybe 4 years, sorry, but I don't really know, but it was a kind of the junior title, junior EFSC. And that was basically level 3, or it was just like we were paid like normal EFSC status. We were nominated like normal EFSC status, but it was kind of like, look, they are new. So it was like, I don't know, like the beginning for us.
So how did you get nominated? Just like someone else knew you who already had an official license?
I was setting the World Cups before I got my nomination. And I was new in the environment, if I can say so. And I got the recommendations from the other EFSC setters.
So then I guess, how did you set your first World Cup? I'm like pressing on this a lot, but I think it's because a lot of people just even want to know how to like break into that kind of job.
I asked and they say yes.
Okay.
So complicated. I mean, now it's really hard to do this that way, and IFSC try to make it really clear and try to make it a clear pathway and create the path for the new road setters who would like to grow and to become IFSC in the future, and it makes sense totally. A few years ago it was more freedom of choosing who will be in the team. I mean, there were some people who were nominated officially, but the other rest of the team was chosen by organization, rather chief could say, maybe we can take this or this person. So everything was more, in between, well, friends, maybe not a good word, but it wasn't so clear and so obvious and so fair, let's say. And that's why now it's changed to be really fair for everybody. To give everybody the same chances to be a part of the World Cups. I had this lucky that Martin was the chief, and I asked Martin, maybe you want to take me? And he said, okay, I will ask if organization, if IFSCs agree, if so, you can join. And and I joined.
All right, so then for people wondering, I guess sometimes the answer is just ask, but now there's it's good to hear that they have more of a process now, so it's a bit more clear.
I think so. I mean, still there is still way to ask, but on the lower level, so not the World Cups, but there are still like Continental Cups. You can try to set them. First of all, to be IFSC road setter, you need to have the national license. And of course, I got it when I was applying. Like this is the first step. So first you need to set national competition. Then once you get your national license, try to set international competition and like step by step. And I did it, of course, but quite fast.
Yeah, really impressive how fast you moved up the ranks, I guess. So you've set for both Boulder World Cups and Lead World Cups. Do you have a preference of setting for one or the other?
Not really. I think I miss Lead a lot because I didn't set any Lead competition this year. But once I had a season with just one Boulder competition and three Lead, I was missing Boulder. So I prefer to mix them and to have, let's say, two Lead, two Boulder competition per season. That would be perfect.
What do you like about each one?
In Boulder, I like the freestyle which we have as a team. The vibes are different in the team. We are more, I don't know, more. It's more funny. It's more jokes. We are all together on the mats, so we are a group. We have a fun time together, like really cooperate in between. We can jump from one boulder to the other, take a break, drink a coffee, whatever you want. So the vibes are fully different. In Lead, it's just me and somebody on one lift. And it's really intense 1 hour together with one person or 3 hours sometimes. And we're really focused on the lead, on the route. And we are like joking in between, of course, but it's different vibe. And the whole process is longer. Like you climb just most of the time, just one per day. In Boulder, you climb and jump a million times per day. So like the dynamic in the team is totally different. And I like both.
And so with the Boulder setting, I feel like recently I've been hearing more about like these Boulder setting guidelines. I don't know if that was just for the Olympics or if it's going to be for World Cups as well. They mentioned needing like a power boulder, a coordination boulder, balancey, electric. I forget all four of the names.
Yeah, you can remember. That's right. Correct.
Okay, cool. So was that just for the Olympics or is that going forward, the new guidelines?
Well, with your question, I'm confused, to be honest. So I know a lot of people will listen to us, and I don't want to give you the wrong answers. In my opinion, it was just for the combined competition. So for those which we also had a Lead, and we need to compare two disciplines together. But I'm not working in the IFSC board. I don't know what will happen in next season. I have no ideas about any decisions. So it's just from my experience, I can say last year we didn't have a guidelines for the World Cups. But this year we had guidelines for the combined competition. And as far as I know, they didn't need to use them during the World Cups, those guidelines.
Okay, that's good to know.
I don't know how it will be in next season.
Did you feel like with the guidelines, it's made setting easier or does it kind of hurt your creativity?
Definitely annoying. In the beginning, I was quite psyched and I was happy we have this clear four types of puller, which make the competition maybe more fair. But afterwards, it's killing the creativity of the status. And after this three competition in a row when I was forced to use the same style of the boulders all over again, it's really tiring. And I prefer to mix the styles more, to try to balance the round, try to balance the styles, but more reasonable. Don't put one coordination. In my opinion, it's better to mix it and to put, let's say, coordination to start and then finish the boulder a pace square or opposite of it. So I hope we won't have any guidelines next year, at least not so strict. So not really focus one style per boulder, but I don't know how it will end up.
Are you worried that with this format, it's too easy for the athletes to learn as well? Like they know what to expect and what to kind of train for?
I don't think so. I don't think so. It's easy for them, or easier or harder. It's like you always have four problems. It's always coordination somewhere. It's always slap somewhere. It's always physical somewhere. It's just you have one style in one boulder. That's it. So we try to avoid two coordination problems, for example, one round. And when we don't have guidelines, we can play tiny more. So we can put the balance section on the different type of the wall than the slab. We can create the slab with the volumes, for example, and make the balance the technical climbing. But with these guidelines, we are always ending up with the balanced slow slab, which we try to make a bit more fast. But like for me, it started to be all over the same.
There was a lot of pressure at the Olympics for the setting and creating equal setting between the boulder and lead rounds. And there were also different setters for boulder versus for lead. So how do you make sure that the boulder lead round is not too difficult one way or the other? Please excuse this brief intermission, but I've gotten a few requests for this, so I just wanted to announce that if you're interested in helping support the show, my Patreon page is now live. Some perks include ad-free, interruption-free episodes, deleted scenes, prioritized guest questions, or the ability to submit video questions, an enamel pin shipped to you after 2 months of membership, and much more to come. The proceeds go back into the podcast to help me break even, and they help improve the experience of the guests. If you'd like to support the podcast non-monetarily, liking, commenting, and sharing helps a great deal as well. Back to the show.
So that's why we had guidelines, and that was the different type of the guidelines, not just the styles, but also how many tops do you want, how many points for first, second, third place, etc., etc., etc. How many tops we want in whole round, how many people will go to the second zone, first zone. Like this, all statistics were in the guidelines. And thanks to that, we didn't need to really communicate in between. We just tried to fit in the guidelines with our predictions. And that's why the guidelines was created, to make our job easier. And it worked, for sure. So we knew which kind of results we expecting, and we knew if we will fit in the guideline with these expectations and the lead will fit with their expectations exactly in their guidelines, then we will meet in the proper balance in between two disciplines.
Do you know what the lead guidelines were?
Oh no, I don't remember, but like similar. So like I don't know, first place in between I don't run 95, 100 points. And then second place in between this and this points, first place, fourth place, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they were like trying to reach this hold for each place, like to reach the good number with the points.
So like, I think for Boulder, you mentioned that they have to, you kind of say like what percentage you think will get 5, 10 or 25 points. Did it work out to the percentages that you were expecting, or were there any big surprises there?
For sure, not in each round. So, for example, the men's semi-final was too hard. I mean, you can see it when you were watching. You don't need to see the guidelines to know it. So, yes, we didn't fit the guidelines because it was slightly too hard. But I don't really, now I don't have, I would need to have a paper and to see the results again and to refresh it because I'm not really good in statistics. I'm not really good in thinking how many, no. I'm more an emotional person. So I do not know surely if we fit perfectly, but to be honest, I don't think so, because it's really hard to do it, and this is just a guideline. It's not something what we have to do. It's like, it would be nice if you can reach this goal, but it's not like it's not now I know just French word, obligatory, sorry.
So like, for example, for men's semis, if the boulder was too hard, do you then go and talk to the lead setters and they adjust it so that lead is like equally as hard, or they make it a bit more difficult?
Not at all. No, we had this unwritten rule that once the boulder round started, the lead team is not touching the lead route. So whatever will happen on the boulder side, they won't change anything on the lead. And that's fair enough. Otherwise, they can turn the results. So like I said, oh, we have this and this. Okay, let's I don't know, make the route harder. Like it's opening the door for cheating. Like, oh, this guy made a bad round in bouldering. Let's make this section easier and give him more points. You know what I mean? It's opening the unsure results. So they didn't, they never changed the route after the boulder round.
Okay. I see how it could open it to cheating. But then I guess people also might be upset that, oh, like it favors lead or I guess it wouldn't favor lead specialists, but that it favors, wait, how does this work? it gets confusing. Okay, so if the lead round is easier, then it goes against the lead specialists.
Yeah, not really, because let's say who is not the list specialist. Oh, no, I know how you can do it. So you can turn up the lead route and make the cracks in the lead route. And then everybody will fall in the wet point, or most of them will fall. And doesn't matter if you're a lead specialist or not, you will fall somewhere. So for the boulders, it's not really good to fall on the, I don't know, number 20. But if you're a medium lead, you also fall in this point. Or you can make the section easier to push the lead guys higher. Mm-hmm. It makes sense, yeah. Or not really what I say.
I think that makes sense, but I guess it seems I get confused by it
for
anyway.
Sure, you can play the for sure you can play with the results. For sure. Mm-hmm. Like you can easily do it. If you already know the places from 1 to 10, you can know, this guy is really poor in crimps. Let's put this crimp better, worse, whatever side you prefer. But you can really create that potentially dangerous situation when you play with who will win or not. I mean, they try to avoid this situation. They try to avoid somebody who will come and say, hey, you change it. Just half an hour before, maybe you want to do this or this for this or this athlete. So to avoid any suspicious, it's like, it's done. We didn't see the boulder round. We didn't know what will happen. We had this scenario, but we are not touching the roots. And that's why we had the guidelines. So if you were following the guidelines, you're supposed to be more or less sure the route or the boulder round fit into the guidelines. Well, like we were talking with the lead team, but it was more like, ha, your route is hard? Yes, it's hard. For example, that was the conversation. Nothing
okay,
more.
That's it. Gotcha.
Like, do you think you will have a top? No, we don't think so. We have a top. Oh, good. Because we also have a good hard round for builders. So it's like not really real talk.
Did you get to like see each other's like boulders and lead route while you were setting?
We were working behind the curtain as a boulder team, so we didn't really see them. But they said they were hearing me. They said, yeah, I was quite loud, but they were seeing us from the top of the lift. But time to time, when they didn't have a job or they had just lifts, when lift was occupied for different stuff. So time to time, the guys from the lead team just came behind our curtain just to hang up, see, watch something. But it was just to be with us for a second. But no, we were totally working as a two separate teams. I don't know how was the connection in between chiefs. Yeah, because I don't know that. They had a lot of meetings. I think they had meetings every day. So that was a big communication, but not on my level as team under.
Okay, makes sense. Yeah, I mean, I feel like it turned out pretty well. And I was listening to like another podcast that you had done, I heard you say that you felt the setting was not perfect, which kind of surprises me because it seems like people actually mostly liked the setting at Paris. I mean, you know, like online people will always be very loud if they're upset about the setting or if, if they were not happy with the results or anything like that. But I think people were mostly positive, which is very rare. So I guess like congrats on that, first of all. There was like, of course, a couple of things that people mentioned. I think one thing was the men's semis being hard. And then I feel like the only other thing, that I saw on like Reddit or YouTube comments or whatever was about, once again, the setting being too high for Aimori. So what kind of precautions did you take as setters to avoid this? And also like, how tall are you?
Well, I'm 158 centimeters with zero span. As far as I know, I is 154, so 4 centimeters in between us. As I mentioned before, I don't know how big is her span, but not minus, as far as we know. So it's rather 4 centimeters less than mine, or a bit less if she has a plus. Well, we were thinking about the sizes all the time, both for men and for the females. So there are athletes who are not in average. So each time we were wondering, oh, maybe this guy can reach. Should we move it further? Are we sure this guy can't cheat? Because it's mostly about the guys. Or with the females, okay, are we all of the females can reach? Is it for sure not Morpho? And we were checking like really a lot of times, and we put a lot of tension about it. And we spend hours about some movements, with talkings, with trying to find a good balance to don't make something reachy. And we're really, really focused about that.
Are you happy with how it turned out?
Well, I'm not happy because we had an athlete who didn't start the boulder, and it's not nice, never. But instead of being sad, I'm more disappointed because I'm sure this move was not Morpho. I'm just sure. So I'm disappointed it happened like that. This move was totally different in the really beginning, totally different. And we changed it because we thought it's Morpho. And it was even worse like than we had actually during the Olympic Games. The worst in terms of the morphologies. And I was like, no, it's just Morpho. It came like that. And we climbed with Tsukasa and we said, no, Rinuk, it's just Morpho. It's not hard, it's Morpho. So we changed that move for the move which was during the Olympic Games. And we decided as a team, this move is okay. And it's just sad and disappointing, as I mentioned before, that I didn't start, and it's just, you know, we want to have a fair round. We expecting we will give the athletes the fair field of play. We are like, this is our job to make it fair. It's something which we want. We want to have the best athlete on the podium. We want to show how good they are, how strong they are, how great the athletes are, and give them the opportunity to fight, to show the greatest. And it's always sad if the boulders, let's say, are too hard, and then you're, okay, we should do this and this and this to let them play. Or if the boulders are too easy, say, not good scenario. So There is always a lot of disappointment and sadness in the setting team if the round it's not as good as we're expecting.
Yeah. So I guess it was more just like the expectation that she should have been able to do it.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. I had no doubts.
Yes. Yeah, I feel like people don't really complain about the height difference in setting for men so much. it is a pretty big difference as well, right? Like setting for maybe like Paul's height versus like Sasha's height.
Yes. I don't know why the people don't complain for that. No.
I mean, that is a bigger difference in terms of height, right?
Probably. Between Sasha and Paul, probably, yes. Then in between I and the biggest was Shiania, I think. Yeah, maybe it's bigger, different. I don't know why. I mean, men are more dynamic than females, for sure, like in general. So the ability of doing easy dynamic movement in easy in terms of intensity, it's not so difficult for men. So in my opinion, the differences in the dynamic in females are bigger than in males. But
okay,
yeah, at least like I mean, in between the strongest athletes, because I is considered as one of the stronger climbers, but she's not the most of the dynamics ones. But yes, she's, because she's winning the lead, she's one of the best. But I don't want to say nothing wrong about anybody. I just want to say, to be the good boulderer, you need to do a lot of things. And it's like just to be strong, it's not enough. You need more.
And I didn't go into this earlier, but I guess, do you have a preference on like setting for men's versus women's?
I prefer set for females, because I'm quite small. So each time setting for me, I need to use more creativity and more, I don't know, sometimes I'm not sure, is it okay or not? And I really need somebody to check who is way taller. I can set for men's, of course, but it's I don't feel so convenient when I set for them. When I was setting for females, but this I'm talking about the World Cup level, not for, I don't know, Polish Cup. For Polish Cup, it doesn't matter for me. But if we're talking about the strongest men in the world, I don't feel convinced to set the physical boulder because I'm not able to do any of the move of this physical man problem. So I can set it, but still, I am not sure if it's possible or not. Is the good level? Is it too hard, too easy? So afterwards, we need to check it as a team.
In general, with your experience at the Olympics, did you stay in the Olympic Village?
No, at all. No, we were living close to the venue. And the Olympic Village was around 40 minutes far away from there.
Oh, that's pretty far, actually.
I don't know if we had access. I didn't check it. I don't know. But we had an access to different sports. So we were watching, for example, gymnastic final. That was awesome. We had an access to opening and close ceremony. And different sports. When we had a rest days, we could just take our passes and go to Paris and watch different sports.
And so between Tokyo and Paris, I think there was only one route setter who has done both of them. Do you have any interest in doing... Oh, really?
Yeah, sorry, that was three. So that was Jan Zbranek and Adam Pustelnik from the lead team. And I think Akito was also setting in Tokyo in lead team, but as a national setter. And from the boulder team, that was Garrett Gregor, who was setting in the Olympic team in Tokyo.
Okay. Well, I guess scratch that question, but do you have any interest in doing more Olympic setting in the future?
If you ask me now, I would say yes. I would like to go to Los Angeles, but I don't know what will happen in next 4 years. It's a really long time. So
yeah.
Let's see.
I'm assuming you would hope that they would separate out boulder and lead.
Not really. I mean, maybe best scenario would be to have the combine plus lead plus boulder.
Yeah, that would be fun.
I mean, I like the combine format. I like the emotions. I like the dynamic in between two. Yeah, I'm not a fan of the gain lines, but it's something what we can talk, we can change, we can make adjustments. So like the guidelines, it's not the thing. Just competition, like these two disciplines together are really cool to watch. And I really like it. And the new generations of climbers, they used to combine. So the kids who were, I don't know, 12 when was the Tokyo, now they are 15. So in Los Angeles, they will be 19. So probably, maybe we will have Olympic medalists who is still in youth now. We don't know. So those who have a big chances to compete in Los Angeles, they will be already the combined athletes, who really grow up like this, not like Adam, who was lead specialist since always. And he needed to adjust himself for this format. A lot of different.
Yeah, I also think combined would be fun. I agree. I think it would be nice to have like a boulder lead and a combined medal. I think that would be a lot of fun to see.
Maybe. It's just for me who watch. It's interesting to see how they struggle, how they fight. Yeah, it's nice, and then it's also like lead changed the dynamic of the routes changed because of the boulders, and it's also great. Like before, we didn't have a 360 on the lead wall, and now it's not nothing strange, and it's great. Like the sport is growing, it's evolving, and it's necessary in sport like that, like our sport, which is great new sport.
But you don't want speed to be combined back in.
Well, no, for sure no. Otherwise, we won't have a medal in Poland. So.
Oh yeah, I guess that's true.
Speed is just something different. It makes no sense to combine us with the boulder and lead. I think everybody knows.
Yeah, it's just way too different. Okay, I think that covers everything I wanted to go into with the Olympics. So now moving a bit more into, I guess, like your personal life. You are also like a mother. I think you have two kids. Do your kids also climb?
Yes, they do. Both of them. Yes.
They enjoy it? Or are you forcing them into it?
No. I mean, they can choose whatever they want in their life. I will support them if their decisions. So far, my daughter, she's dreamed to be the Yania. And this is like something what she would like to achieve. I'm pretty sure it's not possible, but but she loves climb. She have a pleasure to train. She likes compete. So I'm just happy that she enjoy it, and it's great. And my son, he's 7, so he's still trying to find himself in the sports. So he likes climbing, but he also likes soccer, and he's just doing a bit of this, a bit of that, and he's climbing just for fun.
So do they prefer like competition climbing or outdoors?
My son, he's in love in Fontainebleau slabs. He's just crazy good in this. Like, I hate when he's climbing in Fontainebleau because I think he will die. So he prefers that. And my daughter prefers indoor.
Makes sense. And I think I've seen you do like competitions after becoming a mother. How long did it take you to recover just from like giving birth and feeling like you're back to your normal climbing shape?
With my daughter, I did it definitely too fast. But in both pregnancy, I was climbing until my 9th month of pregnancy.
Whoa,
so
really?
Until the end. But wow. I mean, I was climbing just for myself. Like I was moving on the wall, I would call it. I was climbing, I don't know, 6A's because I like to climb 6A's on the top road. But after pregnancy, it took me 1 month after with my daughter, it took me 1 month to come back to the wall after my pregnancy. I was a bit afraid. I wasn't sure if I can already or not. With my son, it was exactly 6 days. So I was already outside climbing. that was quite fast, but it was spring. I really want to go outside. I really want to climb a bit. So yeah, so we went.
You said that you went back to climbing 6 days after giving birth?
Yeah. But after my second kid. Yeah. And it was 6 days.
I mean, still, that's kind of crazy, right?
Yeah, I was feeling good. So why not? It's something what I do since I was a kid. It's nothing weird. My doctor told me, like, better don't start to run, like jogging now, because you never did it before. So it's stupid. But the climbing is something for you, like, your body knows best. So if you feel okay, and it's not exhausting, it was not a training session. It was vertical wall on the top wall. I was just moving up a bit on the super easy route. So nothing crazy. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. And you didn't have like issues when you were climbing when you were like 9 months pregnant either?
No, it was same level of climbing, so it's like 6A or something, like super easy stuff with the huge holds. Yeah. I mean, I really like climbing. It's something what I really appreciate in my life, and I've never considered pregnancy as a disability, and I really wanted to continue my climbing even if I'm pregnant, because to be pregnant is normal, and climbing is also normal, so like why you can't do it? I mean, I know there is a lot of cases, a lot of like every person is different, every pregnancy is different, and like. But in my, I'm talking about myself. I was feeling good, I was feeling healthy, and everything was okay.
Well, very lucky, I guess. Yeah, I've just always been kind of like scared of it. I mean, like, as a kid, I used to watch a lot of videos where people talk about their pregnancy. So I've heard a lot of, like, horror stories as well. And, I mean, some people's stories, it sounds like even just standing up and walking around is, like, the hardest thing in the world. So,
yeah, it's really personal, I guess. I have a lot of accidents in my life, like, recently during Olympics. But yeah, I turned to the hospital in the Budapest. I turned to the hospital. So like, I know, like I know the shit can happen in life, but it doesn't mean it will happen when you're pregnant, or I don't know. I mean, you can walk on the street and you can be hit by a bus. It's some things are happening in your life randomly and you can't have control on it. But when I'm climbing top road in harness on the super easy stuff, I have a full control, and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to know that you don't have to give it up and you can at least still do top rope safely. So that's good to know for anyone who's concerned out there like me.
I think everybody has to talk with their doctors to be sure their body is healthy and their kid is healthy. And with the, yeah, it's really personal decision, and I don't judge anybody, and I don't say it's normal to climb. I say it was normal for myself. And this is two different things.
Yeah. And also you mentioned stuff that happened in like Budapest and Paris, yeah, in right. terms of your health. Do you want to get into that a little bit?
Okay. But in Budapest, I was trying the slab. I fell from the slab, and I don't know how it happened, but I felt really far away from the wall, like really on the end of the mats, where was the volume, and I hit the edge of the volume, which hit my eyebrow, and I cut my eyebrow, and I had two stitches.
Oh, wow. Okay.
yes. And it ended up quite brutal with this. And in Paris, and just one day before the setting, I ate a piece of meat which stuck in my throat, and they need to take it out during the general anesthesia. So also not really lucky.
Not climbing related at all.
No, not really. Not really.
Did you feel like that affected your, I don't know, health,
yes,
setting the rest of the competition?
Yeah, definitely. Like general anesthesia during the first day of setting, like I skipped the first day because I was in the hospital, but I was barely able to walk on the first floor in the hotel. I wasn't able.
Oh, wow.
I wasn't able to go out from the metro. We in one go from the stairs because it was, wow, I can't, like, it's too much for my body. This chemistry or whatever they put in me, it was too much. So almost 2 weeks of sitting in Paris, I was feeling really like weak and really out of breath. And I couldn't try a few times in a row because I just couldn't, like my body said, no, I can't move. So it really affected me. And I was like, sorry guys, I'm really sorry. I really want to push hard, but I can't, like my body can't. And it, like, I came back to myself a bit in the end, like during the comps days, I was more or less feeling better and better with myself. But the beginning was really tough.
Wow. Yeah, I'm surprised you even managed to come back after that and set. That's crazy. I have like no idea how you managed to handle all of that. Even outside of the hospital stuff and all of that, how do you balance like training and traveling and family and motherhood and all of that?
I am really an energetic person. I don't like to sit and do nothing. At home, it's different. I have a lot of time at home because during the day my kids are at school, so I have a time for myself, for my trainings, for manage the house, to do all house, because I'm single mom, so I need to do everything alone, and I can do this when they are at school, and afterwards we have time for ourselves.
I didn't know that you were a single mom, so that makes it even harder. Yeah. Oh my god!
I've never said it's easy. It's challenging, it's hard, it's not really nice, but it's life, and I love my kids, so I try to do everything what's best for them.
Yeah, so do they like travel with you as well when you're off at World Cups?
I don't like to take them with me to the work because I really like to be really focused on my job. And I love my kids and I want to be focused on my kids. So I don't like to put these things, two things together. So it's not common. I take them with me time to time. So when I'm going to the work, they stay at home with the father.
Okay, gotcha. That makes sense. Jeez, that's a lot. I'm just like so shocked that you can do all that. It just seems like a lot at once. I can't even imagine. Outside of your training and taking care of kids and everything like that, what do you do outside of climbing?
As I said in the beginning, I'm surfing a bit, if I have a time. I'm reading books, but I don't know, I think that's it. I mean, all days I spend in normal life to try to manage my life, my kids' lives, and that's what I do all the time. And when I'm going to work, I'm focused on work. I finally have a bit time just for myself. I don't need to think about the kids. So it's work, but afterwards in the evening, it's just time for me. So kind of holidays in different way. So at home, there is not really time to do something crazy. I meet my friends if I can.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, you've clearly got a lot of stuff going on already.
We go to ski in the winter, of course, or snowboard. Or hiking in the weekends, like normal life, like the people have.
Yeah, so you're no longer like doing snowboarding competitions, but I guess you still go quite frequently.
No. When it's like quick, I think I've never stand on the. I mean, no, never. But I think I've didn't stand on the board like 7 years. Kind of.
Oh wow. Okay.
Like I really was done.
That's surprising. I mean, well. Like, why didn't you want to snowboard at all after you quit? Because I can't imagine you like just giving up climbing straight up for 7 years, right?
Because I like to snowboard on the, I'm snowboarding on the hard board. So like the prono, that was my discipline. And the best conditions is just on the really early morning. And I hate to wake up on the really early morning. And I hate winter, and I hate when I'm freezing. So like these three things put me away. If you will tell me like, okay, in 3 seconds, you can be on the perfect slope with the perfect snow, like a slope on the perfect snow on the board, and it will be sunny, I don't know, -3 degrees. Like, okay, I'm into it. But the whole process to get there, nah, like I'm not enough motivated to do it.
Yeah, I can agree with that. Do you have any interest in like competing again in the future? Maybe not at like not at all.
No. That was really hard decision for me to quit, especially when I was qualified. So it was since a few years, I was like, okay, I will quit. No, I will stay. I will quit. I will stay. It was a big battle in myself. And once I made a decision, I stayed with my decision. And that's more or less how I act in my life. You know, you will decide something, it's like that. And I'm not the person who's changing the mind.
Yeah, well, I was talking about like competing and climbing, not at like a super high level, but just like local competitions or something like that.
It's not, but no, in climbing, yes, I do time to time. I compete in Poland. If there are cool, fun competition in my hometown, and I'm not setting, why not? Yes, I always have a fun to compete.
Kind of inspirational to hear about how much you managed to do at once with balancing your family life and and competing and traveling and all of that. So I think that was very helpful for me to learn, because I just I don't know anyone who does it, so that's good to know. Okay, so let's move on to a few of the last questions we have from like Discord and people in the community. This one is referencing a video that you were in with the IFSC where you were introducing the 360 ghost holds, if you remember that.
Yes, sorry, I remember. I do, yes. I think that was Hachiyochi 2023. Yeah, 1 year ago. Actually.
Yeah, and that was a big competition. Lots of complaints about that one. So this question is asking, I remember you were in that video introducing the ghost holds, and it got completely flooded with negative comments. How do you manage that, dealing with negative comments? How did you experience it? And in general, how do you deal with the barrage of bad setting comments when things don't go entirely to plan?
I've never read all of the comments under that video, but those who I was reading were mostly about the hold and not about myself. So I didn't really care too much. I didn't agree with most of them, and that's it. Like, if I have a chance to talk with somebody, I can explain something. I mean, the history behind this video, it's quite funny, because it was just a question. Oh, Olga, do you like this hold? Maybe you can say something about this hold. And I was like, yeah, actually, I really like this hold. Of course, I can say good things about double bits because it's a good hold. And it was really, really spontaneous conversation in between me and Matt. And we were repeated video because the light was bad or the voice was bad. And he said, I'm mumbling, or et cetera, et cetera. So like, it was okay. Really random talk about the whole during the setting. And I didn't pay attention too much. Like, I didn't understand why the people were so upset about this. Like, afterwards, I did, after the Yannick Floe comment, I had a conversation with Yannick Floe about this. And now I understand. At that time, I didn't really care. Like, the people sometimes are upset about something, but they don't have a full knowledge about the subject. So why should I be sad about these comments?
Well, I guess like now we've seen the hold used quite a lot do you feel like people have changed their thoughts on it? Like, people like it now?
The biggest issue with the hold and the biggest problem which the people had, that was you can't see where you can grab the hold. That was the most comments, at least those which I wrote, read, because I didn't read all. But that was the thing which made the people angry or whatever. And the reality is, it's not like that. So once you see the hold and you're climbed, you really know where you have to grab it. And I guess the people need the time to understand that what they assumed the time was incorrect, and actually what, like, all the fears which they had are not here. Like, it's not like that. It's normal hold with the cool ID, with the nice visuality, and it works like all of the holds. Like, when you're a pro athlete, you already know where to grab it. So it's not it's a new thing. In the beginning, it's a bit weird, but you can use to it easily. And these holds now are on the gyms, and the people have no problem with those holds.
Yeah. So yeah, that's true.
It was, I think the people are scary in the beginning about new things, time to time. And that was the kind of hate, like, just scary.
So that was mainly just on the hold itself. What about when you see comments about when it is about the setting, or maybe like a boulder that you specifically worked on? Is there like a time where it was your boulder and people just really shat on it online?
I don't really even know where I can read those comments. If I set the comp, I don't watch the YouTube comp.
Okay, that makes
competition.
Sense.
Because I know the competition. I'm not coming back to those videos. I tried to find any comments and I couldn't. And I don't know if I'm looking for badly or what, but it's not easy for me to find these all negative comments. It's more like what I hear behind me or in between friends, but no, not like randomly, not really. Okay.
Maybe that's the way to do it. Don't read the negative comments.
Maybe somebody will comment under my post, then of course I will see it. But I don't know. I've never, it never hit me. Like, it was time to time see something negative, but yeah.
Well, that's good. Okay, next question. Do you want the Boulder 2-zone format to stay or go?
Definitely go. I'm not a fan of 2-zones format. I recently explained it, so I will repeat myself quickly. I believe that simple bowler is the best bowler, and 2-zones just extending our problems, and we can't have really short, really basic, really bowler. Because of the 2-zones format. And we can't really play on the end of the boulder, which is supposed to be the hardest part. Because once the athlete will reach the end part of the boulder, there is not so many time of the clock on the clock. So in reality, if the 5 and 10 points are for something, the athlete has one or two attempts on the top, and it's most of the time not enough to play with something cool. If we have just 1 zone, we can play on the beginning, and there is still at least half of the time for the second part. And I think it's more visuality enjoyable to watch if there is 1 zone instead of 2.
Okay, so you mean like setting like, maybe not a brand new move, but something that would be hard for them to figure out.
For sure, we can play more with the attempts if we have just 1 zone, because we can, you can see how the athlete is learning during the process, and we can push more, we can play more, we can give them bigger challenge on the 1-zone format. And most of the time, where we were setting the World Cups, we were trying to avoid to have two crooks on the world ruler, because most of the time it's too much and there is not enough time for the top part. And with the two zones, we always need to have these two crooks. So now, after the OQS, we realized like the 5 points needs to be really easy and needs to be accessible for everybody. And it's like almost for nothing. So why we are forced to use it if it's actually for nothing?
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, next question. How do you continue to improve your route setting skills?
Setting as much as possible and with as many different people as possible, with as many different countries as possible. So just to don't stay in one place. For myself, it's the best is to experiment, to switching the environments, switching the teams, switching the team members, to play with different parts of the globe, and then you can learn faster and more efficient because you're not in the routine all the time. You are experiment with the different people, and I think that like for me the people are the most important factor in a road setting, because it's us who are the team and who create something on the road.
Do you feel like there's a country that you like their setting the most?
For me, it's France, because they have an exceptional vision of the road setting of the movement in general. But it's just me, in my opinion.
What's like different about it? Like, is it just slabs or everything in general? Because I hear a lot about their slabs, but I don't know about the other stuff.
But everything, I guess, everywhere when I was, there are great road setters and really good gyms. But in French, almost everywhere is really good. So the level almost everywhere is high. And the expectations are high. So it's good because you are forced to do the good job. And if it's, the job is not good, you really feel disappointment. And I think it's something really positive thing. I mean, at least what I like. And when you are going on the random Parisian gym, you will find really good polars over there. And it's not like this in different countries, not in all of gyms.
Okay, I'll have to go back to Paris and try out all the gyms. Okay, and last question that we got, I think it might have been a little bit answered before, but in case you have a different answer for this, what are some unique challenges that you face as like a mother and professional setter? I've heard women athletes who have to feed their infants during halftime of a game. Just curious about what it was like for you during pregnancy or postpartum.
During pregnancy, I didn't work. So as a road setter. Afterwards, the biggest challenge for me was missing my kids. So I was missing so much. So the biggest problem for me, it was to spend too many days out of the house without them. But with the time, when they grow up, it's easier and easier and easier. They don't need me so much. So it's just turned with the time. Now I feel they are safe when I'm not at home. I feel they are happy that I'm not with them. So it's not really... I have a feeling it's harder for me than for them. So somehow it makes me feel comfortable that I'm not at home with my kids, because I'm sure they are okay without me. Time to time I take them for the commercial setting, because it's just 8 hours and they play around, they climb, they, I don't know, read book, watch the movie, do something. But they grow up on the climbing gyms. They... there were a few months when I was climbing. I don't know, my kid was 3 months old. I was breastfeeding, I was climbing, I was breastfeeding, climbing. So they grow up in the climbing gyms. This is normal environment for them. They like it, they enjoy it. And it's not a problem for them to join me for my training session or spend time with me. And yeah, so I think now I'm in the time in my life when my kids are growing enough to let them do whatever they want. And yeah. And they just don't need me so much.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a big difference between like ages 0 to 3, and then after that, yeah, it gets a lot easier.
Yeah, it's like the huge difference in between once you turn out 2 years old. It's like new kid, wow, I don't need to do this and this and this. And then it's again when you turn out 4 and 5 and 7 and 10. It's like the new big problems appearing, but different problems are gone. So it's switching all the time.
Okay, good to know. Very, it's always an exciting journey, I guess.
Yeah, it's to be a mom or dad, it's a hard job. It's definitely a hard job. I think everyone knows that who are parents.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, I think that is all the questions I had. Thanks for joining me today. Any like last thoughts that you have?
No, I think I'm really happy I'm here. Thank you very much for the invitation and for the questions.
Yeah. Do you want to let people know where they can find you if they have any other questions?
Yes, of course. I have an Instagram profile. My name and surname, so Olga Niemetz. And if somebody has any questions, please write me. I will try to answer. Like, don't feel stress or something. Yeah.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you again. And it was amazing to talk.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you so much for making it to the end of the podcast. Don't forget to like and subscribe if you enjoyed. Otherwise, you are a super fake climber. If you're listening on a podcasting platform, I'd appreciate if you rate it 5 stars, and you can continue the discussion on the free competition climbing Discord linked in the description. Thanks again for listening.